To the book of Job, chapter 4, and the first two verses. Job, chapter 4, verses 1 and 2. Then Eliphaz, the Temanite, answered and said, "If we were assay to commune with thee, wilt thou be grieved? But who can withhold himself from speaking?" And I've called our study tonight the case against evangelicalism. That is the view of the gospel which sees the salvation of God revealed and the conversion of souls. But there are critics, and they were here in the book of Job. And we're going to see their comments, their criticisms, how like those that are made today, and the way in which they're responded to. We've been looking at Job, and we've noticed what God says about him. And his salvation, which was certain, and his sanctification. He was a sanctified man, a godly man, described as a perfect man, and his devotion was unfailing, unfading. But he has a calling, and he doesn't know it. And his particular calling will be to demonstrate the efficacy and the power of conversion. And Satan, unusually, is going to be allowed to go to extremes in his attacks upon Job in order to bring him down. But Job will demonstrate that the truly converted man, here is the doctrine of the perseverance of the saints, will not fall. God will sustain him. The work of grace that has been wrought within him has brought in eternal life. And he cannot fall, and he cannot fail. And that's going to be demonstrated by Job. Poor Job doesn't know it. He doesn't know that that is the ultimate purpose of all his sufferings. So he cannot understand them. Why has God dealt so harshly with him? And he gets very near to break down, but he never denies the Lord. He questions his fairness and his justice, and he's guilty of some terrible things in that respect, but he never denies him and he never loses hope. But now, first of all tonight, we must hurry into this. Eliphaz launches his attack. What do we make of the friends of Job? These three men who feature chiefly in this book. And they have formed a kind of confederacy against Job. What do we make of them? Well, it's an ancient literary circle. Three very wealthy men like Job, a country squire. He was the greatest in the East at the time for his herds and his flocks and his holdings and his land and so on. And they came from considerable distance, one would think, these three friends, from their different regions to communicate with Job. And they would sit down together, anyone's guess for how long, perhaps a week, perhaps more, and do this quite often. And they were brilliant poets, as we see from the material in the book. And they would argue and reason with one another, but the three friends are not converted. They're people who believe that they worship God and believe in him, but they're self-righteous individuals, and they believe in securing the favor of God and proximity to God by their own merit and their own lives. And they won't listen to Job. And although this isn't evident in the earliest chapters, as we go through the book, we see the evidence of it piling up. Job, quite in contrast to them, has an evangelical testimony. And he believes that God requires perfection, and man cannot bring perfection because of his sinful state and condition. So he must come to God seeking salvation by grace alone, by the mercy of God. He probably knows Genesis 3:15, though not written yet by Moses, the sentiments of ancient times were passed down and known, the promise of God after the fall of man in the Garden of Eden, that a great descendant was coming who would be the salvation of all. He probably knew about the promises made to Abraham and the oldest of the patriarchs about the great descendant, which was Christ, who would one day come and so on and bring deliverance. He believed in grace and he trusted in the mercy of God. He had, and we'll see it if we get to it a little later on, he refers to God's words, which would no doubt have been this oral tradition which came down to the family of Abraham and Job, who was a not too distant relative of Abraham. Well, here's the attack made by the friends. The friends, so-called, are enemies. And one of the great lessons of the book of Job for Job is that he's wasted a lot of time making his best friends people who did not share his love for God and his service for him. And when it came to a crisis, they would turn against him because they would show that all along they hated his testimony. So Eliphaz, this is how it unfolds in chapter 4. He says, "If we assay to commune with thee, wilt thou be grieved?" It's a warning. He's coming in on the attack. But who can withhold himself from speaking? And he says here, "Behold, thou hast instructed many." And some people are very kind to them. They say, oh, the friends, when they started, they meant so well. And they were very kind to Job. And they acknowledged to Job that he'd been a very good teacher and instructor and all the rest of it. But look, this is sarcasm. "Behold, thou hast instructed many. Thou hast strengthened the weak hands. Thy words have upholden him that was falling. Thou hast strengthened the feeble knees. But now misfortune is come upon thee. And look at you. You crumble, you faint. It touches you, and you're troubled." They didn't mean it to be complimentary. They were working up to the punch, as it were. Verse 6, "Is not this thy fear, thy confidence, thy hope, and the uprightness of thy ways?" Doesn't this betray that you don't really have confidence in God? You don't really have hope in him. Your ways are not upright because you're so terrified by what God is doing to you now. And then Eliphaz begins to unfold his theology, if we may call it that. Verse 7, "Remember, I pray thee, whoever perished being innocent, or where were the righteous cut off, even as I have seen, they that plough iniquity and sow wickedness reap the same. By the blast of God they perish." And it's going to amount to this. This is bedrock to us because Eliphaz speaks for himself, but you soon discover he goes to the plural and that he's speaking for the other friends too. They've got their heads together. They've planned this. And this is their view. You can earn the favor of God. And we have, by the way, they mean to say. And we have been reasonably righteous, and so God has prospered us. You've always been telling us we need more. We need this supposed conversion. We need to go on our knees and repent and seek the mercy of God. And that you have a superior religious standing. This has offended them. But now, look at you. Look at the state you're in. Look at the condition. Look at what God has done to your family and to your wealth. You're now in poverty and you're at the point of death. And this proves that you're under the punishment of God. You're a hypocrite, Job. You've got vast secret sin. You kept it from us. You masqueraded as a special friend of God. But it's certain, because this is unassailable, that if you have good fortune, God is pleased with you. If you're in trouble, God is punishing you, even now. That's what they believe. That's what they hold to. But there's more to it. And they go on, I'm going to hop over pieces, but verse 10 here, even strong beasts, the lion, it's the same. They come to a point, they're under the judgment of God. In a way, it doesn't help the argument, but they think it does. But look at verse 12. Now, up till now, the theology that Job must be corrupt because he's being punished by God depends upon their reason. That's how they reason things. They don't have revelation, they have reason. But they add revelation to it. Although, interestingly, it's a form of revelation which is still subject to their reason. Verse 12. Now a thing was secretly brought to me, and mine ear received a little thereof. Very humble start. I've had a little small revelation, a small communication from God. It gets more charismatic as it goes on. Verse 13. In thoughts from the visions of the night, when deep sleep falleth on men. It's not going to be 100% vision. God would give him a vision, and then it would be down to his personal reason to make sense out of it. So even when this Eliphaz has got a revelation, it's still subject to what he thinks. Verse 14, it's made very impressive. Fear came upon me and trembling, which made all my bones to shake, and a spirit passed before my face. The hair of my flesh stood up. It stood still, but I could not discern the form thereof. This is a special divine revelation. An image was before mine eyes, silence, and a voice. And what did the voice say? Verse 17, this is dynamite. The voice of his revelation said, shall mortal man be more just than God? Shall a man be more pure than his maker? Astonishing. Now, first of all, obviously, it refers to Job having been crying out, suggesting that God was not being fair to him. And Eliphaz, in effect, is saying, how dare you criticize the fairness of God? Should you, a mere man, be more fair than God, more just than God? What is happening to you is bound to be just. But there's more to it than that. This expression, shall mortal man, our translators have it, shall feeble man, is nearer to the sense of the Hebrew. Shall feeble man be more just than God? You see, what has been so irritating Eliphaz and the other two for so long is Job's idea that if you were to have peace with God and communion with him and be accepted with him by your own works and merits, then you would have to be as holy as God. And they hate that idea, because if you have to be as holy as God, then salvation by works collapses. Nobody would ever think they could be as holy as God. To take the view, as the liberal theologian does, and as so many do, and as other religions do, to take the view that you can please God by your own merits, if that means being as he is, well, the game's up. No hope. You've got to have the idea that God sets a lower standard for man than he has himself. That all he expects of us is a reasonable performance. And when describing this, I often use the example of examinations. The examiner The examiner doesn't expect you to get 100%, but it'll certainly pass you if you get 90 or 80 or 70 or even 51. And I think even lower now, in some exams. He'll be very pleased and he'll pass you. He doesn't expect you to be perfect. And God's like that. So this has always been something infuriating to them. We are disqualified in Job's mind as being accepted by God because we're not perfect. And this sarcasm comes in here. By revelation, he claims, shall mere man, feeble man, be more just than God? Shall a man be more pure than his maker? That's ultimately, as the saying goes, his beef here, his complaint, what's annoying him. Behold, God puts no trust in his servants, and his angels he charged with folly. How much less in them that dwell in houses of clay? See the belittling nature of this? Do you think God would expect so much from people who live in houses made of dirt? That's ultimately what we all live in. Whose foundation is, again, in the dust, in the dirt? We want a path, we make it out of dust and dirt and stamp it down. Which are crushed before the moth. You die, put in the grave, and you're at the mercy of the moth, which destroys your body. They are destroyed, verse 20, mere men, from morning to evening, they perish forever. Doth not their excellency which is in them go away, die away? So Eliphaz has ridiculed the notion that God expects righteousness from human beings. And that's the nature of his attack. And he gets it from reason, and he gets it, so we're to believe, from a dream he thinks he had, which confirms his view. So his authority for his belief is very flimsy. But he goes on now, and he continues to criticize in chapter 5, and I shall be quick, because time is rushing on. Call now, says Eliphaz, if there be any that will answer thee, and to which of the saints wilt thou turn? Wise men of old, who can you go to confirm your views? Well, Job could have gone to them, but they're not known to Eliphaz, and he continues with his discourse in chapter 5. He begins to accuse Job now, more specifically. Verse 2, wrath killeth the foolish man, and envy slayeth the silly one. The great enemies are anger and envy. You've clearly been guilty of those, he suggests to Job. He advances no evidence, but then he supports his view. I've seen foolish people taking root, and suddenly they disappeared from the earth. They died. Their children are no longer safe. Their estate goes to ruin, and people overrun it. And it's eaten by strangers, the hungry. Verse 5. And then he says this, don't you know, Job, no sorrows come without your deserving them. Verse 6, although affliction cometh not forth of the dust, this is a congenial earth, a neutral earth. You'll never get any trouble from the ground, says Eliphaz. Well, that's nonsense, but that's his reasoning. Verse 7, it's man who's the trouble. Yet man is born unto trouble as the sparks fly upward. What a statement. Actually uttered by a godless and proud man who is attacking Job. And yet a very beautiful statement. And that's his view. Man is born unto trouble because he's under the judgment of God. Except us, Eliphaz thinks, he has only God's favor because he's been good enough. So his advice to Job is, verse 8, I would seek unto God, and unto God would I commit my cause. He does marvelous things. He's very forgiving. He lifts up, verse 11, those who are low. On the other hand, verse 12, if you're crafty and you've got hidden sin, he'll destroy you, even now in this life. Another beautiful statement that the Apostle Paul takes up and uses quite differently. Verse 13, he taketh the wise in their own craftiness, and the counsel of the froward is carried headlong. But these beautiful poetic statements are all used in support of a dud theology. You can earn the favor of God, and if you have a bad time in life, it's because you're under God's punishment and judgment, and there's no other explanation. And he goes on along those lines pretty well all the way to the end of the chapter, promising Job that if he would repent, then his fortunes would be greatly changed. Chapter 6. But Job answered and said, oh, that my grief were throughly weighed and my calamity laid in the balances together. You friends, he knows that there's a confederacy, a conspiracy. He knows that Eliphaz speaks for all of them. They're all going to say the same thing. He says, if only you would weigh my grief and think about this. Job is going to be saying, do you really think I could have been so evil as to deserve what has come upon me? I'm struggling to find a reason. You're not helping me at all. You're not weighing things, he says. You're ready to suppose I am such a hypocrite. I have so much secret sin. I am so wicked and so bad. So he complains. Verse 4, for the arrows of the Almighty are within me. The poison whereof drinketh up my spirit. The terrors of God are against him. And poor Job, he cannot think that he deserves anything as bad as this. Of course, he doesn't know that he has a high calling, that he, of all people in the entire history of the world, is going to be the prime demonstration of the efficacy of conversion. And he's going to win through. But he doesn't realize it. Same with us. We can't see the object of our trials when we're sorry for ourselves. Verse 10, then should I yet have comfort. This is pivotal. Yea, I would harden myself in sorrow. Let him not spare, for I have not concealed the words of the Holy One. Whatever was he referring to? He didn't have a Bible then. That hadn't begun. The book of Genesis isn't written. This very book, when Job settles down to write it, is probably going to be the oldest of the written scriptures. Well, he means the words passed down by the holy oral tradition. What happened in the Garden of Eden? What our forebears went through? How God dealt with Abraham? These were precious, precious sayings and narratives that were rehearsed one to another. And Job had kept them and treasured them. And he complains, therefore, about the unfairness of God. Verse 15 of chapter 6. My brethren have dealt deceitfully as a brook. They're in this together. He's only heard so much from one of them, but he knows that this is a conspiracy. Deceitfully as a brook and as the stream of brooks they pass away. Some of those books in that region we're going to read, they are deceptive. They're there one moment and they've gone the next. Verses 16, 17, 18 is a poetic description of the unreliability of books. There were evidently famous stories. Verse 19 is probably a reference to one. The troops of Tamar looked. The companies of Sheba waited for them. It seems as though sometimes even troop movements in the warring factors of those days went out, and their instructions were, walk until you arrive at Brook so-and-so. There you settle the camp, pitch your tents, refresh everyone. And when they got there, there was no brook, no water, a great setback, and they perished perhaps, or it was greatly disadvantage in the battle. And that's what this sudden reference to Tamar and Sheba is about, the unreliability of the brook. And Job is poetically describing his friends. There's a pastoral lesson, as I mentioned, going on. It's occurring to Job, and it will do so repeatedly. Why did I spend so much time with these friends? Why did I spend, as a Christian, so much time with this unspiritual pursuit? This, perhaps we've got our own equivalents to Job's friends, to this particular field of study, to whatever it is that's fascinated us and occupied us, to this or that hobby. You don't meet many Christians, at least I don't, with time-consuming hobbies that have little profit. So I've met some in my time, family that spent much of its life building a fantastic model railway in the garden. Christians, how would they ever have the time for the service of the Lord and for pursuits like that? But here it is, it's coming across to Job. The people, I knew they were not saved, but they were my closest friends. They really fulfilled me and satisfied me. And they're just like brooks which disappear. And it's a bitter lesson to have to learn. Just on to verse, he says in this chapter more or less, what are you precisely accusing me of? You've said I'm a hypocrite. You've said anger and envy. But you haven't given any evidence. You haven't given me any help, any details. If I only knew, I'd listen to you. If you could say to me, you've done this and this and this, then I would have to listen. But these are just vain words that crush me. And in chapter 7, he complains. And he complains in the early verses that he's got no hope, and his flesh is clothed with worms and clods of dust, skin broken, and he's become loathsome. Chapter 7, verse 6, my days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle. I'm just tossed to and fro through the hours of the day. Verse 7, remember, my life is wind. Better to translate that as breath. It's as frail and fleeting as a last breath. He's convinced in the following verses that he's going to die very soon. And then he complains to God directly. Verse 12, am I a sea? What does that indicate? Well, a sea can be tranquil, can be calm, but it can be violent. Multiple thousands of tons of water crashing into a coastline and demolishing everything before it, crashing down on a vessel at sea. These were ancient times, and bringing it under. A sea can be a destructive force. And Job says to God, am I a sea? Have I destroyed anything? Oh Lord, have I hurt thy word, thy people, the message? Have I been destructive in this? Am I a sea or a whale that thou settest a watch over me? And he begins to complain more and more. How long before my death, before I have peace? Well, our time is out. Chapter 8, Bildad. We must come into this, but not tonight. He comes in with an attack, which is very intriguing, which we'll take some highlights from. And Job replies to him in chapter 9, how should a man be just with God? And that's going to be the key to the whole argument. And Job begins to extol God's wisdom and his power. But he says, is he fair? Job is almost on a knife edge. Will he now deny his God? He hasn't up till now, but he's been brought to the point where his question is he being fair with me? And that brings him to the very tipping point. Danger zone. Never, never question the fairness or the providence of God. And Job will learn this. God is always fair. He learned the great privilege which he had, the task that he was set. He will triumph in the end. But you can see the pastoral lesson in his life. The greatest point of danger was once the friends had got him to the point where he questioned not God, but whether he was fair. And that's a lesson for us all. But that's enough for us this evening in our study of this great book of Job. And we'll close with the singing of the hymn number 519. Hymn 519, God of love.